An Wissenschaft wird heute nicht mehr geglaubt, sie wird verhandelt. Wir handeln mit Wissen und Informationen, wir sind Kaufleute des Lichts, Produzenten und Konsumenten, Interpreten roher Daten und hart erkämpfter Erkenntnisse. Doch wer die Grenzen verständlicher Forschung austesten will, muss nicht mehr besser, schneller oder effizienter kommunizieren, sondern über die Kommunikation kommunizieren. Und damit herzlich willkommen zum Podcast Virale Wissenschaft. Ich bin Patricia Quatsch und in dieser Podcast-Folge spreche ich mit der Naturwissenschaftlerin Dr. Augusta Modestino von dem Berliner Biotechnologieunternehmen iCura. Wir haben uns Anfang Februar getroffen und einen regen Austausch über die Big Data in industriefinanzierter Forschung und in biomedizinischen Unternehmen gehabt. Augusta hat als promovierte Wissenschaftlerin im Bioengineering viele Jahre in den USA gelebt und gearbeitet, bis sie dann zu iCura nach Berlin gewechselt ist. Dort ist sie nun Head of Strategy, sie ist also verantwortlich für die Entwicklung kommerzieller Produkte auf einer wissenschaftlichen Basis für die Medizin. iCura ist also eine sehr große Datenplattform, um die klinische Forschung zu beschleunigen. Wir haben daher vor allem über ihre Arbeit in diesem Unternehmen gesprochen und auch über die Rolle von künstlicher Intelligenz und eben der AI-gestützten Datenauswertung und Erhebung. Ihre Expertise hat sich Augusta in sehr unterschiedlichen Bereichen angeeignet, von der Grundlagenforschung in der Biochemie bis zur Produktentwicklung im Gesundheitswesen und verschiedenen diagnostischen Verfahrensweisen. Auch darüber werden wir uns also austauschen. Während im Februar uns also die Kälte noch richtig in den Knochen saß, haben sich zwei Frauen in der Küche unterhalten, um über die, sagen wir mal, alltäglichen Dinge in der Wissenschaft zu sprechen. Was Frauen halt eben so in der Küche tun, natürlich Wissenschaft betreiben. Diese Folge wird auf Englisch sein. Ich hoffe daher, dass unsere Zuhörerinnen mit unserem Non-Native Englisch zurechtkommen. Eine Transkription auf Englisch und auch auf Deutsch ist gerade noch in Bearbeitung. Zunächst aber erstmal viel Spaß beim Reinhören oder auch Zuhören. Well, dear Augusta, welcome to our podcast show Viral Science. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited about the conversation we're about to have.
Yeah, me too. Before we get started, let us warm up a little bit. As we talked about it a few months ago when we met each other, we talked a lot about pandemic, about the communication of science during the pandemic in the German TV, in the German social media, right? So people all over the world were triggered by mail and disinformation. The discussion about the vast-produced vaccines heated up the global competition of pharmacological entrepreneurs, accelerated the basic research as well as new techniques and applied science. We had YouTube conversations, Instagram, Twitter. All of them informed the public about every scientific and political step that was taken to flatten the curve. We all already have heard it, right? Flatten the curve.
Yeah, I almost forgot, or like on purpose forgot about this flatten the curve situation.
Me too. So everyone in Germany was once in his lifetime an expert in how to flatten the curve, right?
Yeah. Everybody became a virologist all of a sudden.
It was really crazy. Was epidemiologists.
Yeah.
So. But you are not an epidemiologist, you are a biologist, biological research, right, with interdisciplinary training. First of all, how was your impression of the last 3 years of pandemic seen from your perspective, also as a researcher, but I mean also as a human, normal human being with an everyday life?
Yeah.
So... Have you been immune against this disinformation? Because you said you are an expert in biology and you know how it works, or was it also like a little bit?
Yeah. Well, so I'm not an epidemiologist, virologist, immunologist, so I wouldn't call myself like an expert in this field, right? Mm-hmm. So I was all always like searching for information, just like a lay person would.
Okay.
Like, because, yeah, I'm just, this is not like my area of expertise. Mm. I have the tools to understand that faster than maybe somebody without like a scientific background.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not my field of study.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what was shocking for me is that people with no scientific background were becoming like epidemiologists all of a sudden and virologists and had very strong opinions on certain things that were sometimes against the opinions of like people that were like truly experts on things. So this was like a little bit shocking.
Mm.
In this case, I was a little bit immune to that because like I was like going to the source. I was like, you know, I'm trained to read like very dry and dense
mm-hmm.
scientific manuscripts,
mm.
but the general population cannot do this.
Yeah.
So like in this case, I was a little bit more immune because I could just go to the sources, read it and be like, okay, I understand. This is what's happening. This is what I should be doing.
Mm.
Or this, like the opinion of experts makes sense or doesn't make sense. So in this case, I was a little bit more immune than maybe the general population.
Yes, I understand. So what was your first source of information in first place?
So I think do
you remember that?
So I think in Germany it was like the Robert Koch Institute.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. This is what I like follow. And then like was going through actual scientific papers that sometimes were not peer review.
Okay.
So in science, and this is because I don't know who the audience is, so like so essentially like what you do is you send a manuscript first, and then you have some reviewers that look at the papers, and then they get approved for publication, they get published, and people can get access to them, right?
It was, it is public access, right, to the peer review?
Public
somewhere.
Access to an extent, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
like some of this, like, but that's another conversation. Some of the publishers then like have it in a, like a, behind a paywall, and now mm-hmm. you have to access by paying mm-hmm. and all of this. So public-ish access.
Mm-hmm.
But during the pandemic, because the speed of the information was so fast and also the need to have this information mm-hmm. fast was so high, then a lot of the publications were first like thrown without being peer review.
Yeah. I once saw a peer review on a expert site, which there were I think 400-500 comments on it. Like you can do that in your experiment, and this also doesn't really work when you do this and that. And I was, as a lay person, really shocked how much of the conversation was really like very inter and transdisciplinary from different positions, and it was not so easy also for the experts to decide, okay, can we go with this article, with this experiment or not?
I mean, this of course, because like also like I don't think that we were, and still I don't think we are prepared for like the speed that the information is like being generated, you know? Before, like, I don't know, you was a scientist in all of your career, you had to read like a couple hundred papers and that's it.
Mm.
If right now, like a couple hundred papers get published every day.
Yes.
Like how do you...
You need speed reading.
You need speed reading and
yeah.
you need like to have a way of managing this information, and we don't have it. I mean, now we're getting like into like some AI tools that can help you with this, but like you as a person, you cannot do it. Like it's impossible like to actually absorb all of this speed. And during the pandemic, it was like really difficult to do. It was also a scary time for a lot of people. Like you know, I was in a lucky group. I was talking to some friends about this yesterday, actually, how because we were like in the early 30s, all of us, we were in this lucky group of people that had jobs that were secure because we didn't have to like go to a place. We also were young, like young enough in any case, healthy.
Mm.
So like we were...
Not in the group of the vulnerables.
Exactly, very privileged in this sense. Mm. So like we lived it in the best way of all of the groups, I think, because also most of us didn't have children, so you didn't have to deal with what do I do with my children at home and how do I keep them safe. Mm-hmm. So we were quite lucky, like I was quite lucky in this sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I was less scared, and I could take the time, and also I have like the training to take the time. Mm-hmm. And for better or worse, I have never been so much into social media. Like, so also I just didn't have this, like, you know, flux of information coming to me all mm-hmm. the time, and had mm-hmm. to fight it just because I never had it, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm.
That's a very good point. But so you're also immune against social media.
Yeah, and like point. but yeah. and I think, and I say like for better or worse, because like, you know, it sounds novel nowadays to be like, no, I don't, you know, I don't have Instagram, but sometimes I miss out things because I don't have it.
Yes.
And it also, like, I think that these tools do have a positive thing as well. It's just like sometimes the negative is pretty high though, or like yes. the price that you have to pay for it is yes. quite high. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's not all like, oh, I'm super noble, I don't need social media, I can avoid it. But
yeah, so that's the point. Science became viral,
yeah,
like a virus in biology, right? And I read in Twitter that now X a lot of about how scientists, experts were communicating about their papers via Twitter.
Yeah.
And this was really crazy, because then you could read simultaneously the paper and the comments on Twitter, and also the preprints discussions
yeah.
were posted there. Now my question is, as a researcher, you have experiences for 10 years, more than 10 years mm. of experience in this field, not just in Germany, but the US.
Yeah.
You were trained in the US. So was this surprising for you that actually in US American context, they have a lot of communication via Twitter, the scientist communication, also the UK, from UK.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also Christian Drosten also started, but he was a little bit more, I should say, very careful.
Yeah.
Right? So do you share any knowledge,
so
any...
I personally don't, because I don't do social media.
Yeah.
And this is something that I'm, like, this is in a case that I think that I'm missing out.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually having this space to have this conversation is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
However, like, this comes with a caveat. This is now open to the general public.
Mm.
And we as scientists, we are trained to understand that science changes
mm-hmm.
as we gain more information. So today, I don't know, we think that this, I don't know one example, but like, we think something is true today. We get more information, and now maybe we will think that this thing is not true anymore, and it's false. And like, as scientists, we don't think that the first person lie, we just think that science mm-hmm. learn, like,
yes.
But the general population doesn't know how to deal with this, actually.
Yes.
Like, and things that, oh, this person just told me that this first thing was true, and now they're like denying it.
Yeah.
So who do I trust?
Yeah.
So this person is a liar, so now he's telling me to believe another thing. And this is not really...
Yeah, because the public
happening.
Judges, right?
Exactly, and judges and also doesn't have the tools, right?
Yes.
Like, we were trained to think in this way and to
mm-hmm.
understand that this is the way that science
yeah.
works.
Yeah.
That science learns more, and sometimes what we thought that was true 10 years ago is no longer true,
yeah.
and this is okay. The first person that said it with the information that they had in hand. Now we have more information in hand, and now this change is always like a hypothesis. As scientists, we never, like, or at least we really try really hard never to say something definite, you know?
Mm. Yes, that's the point.
And the general population really looks for something definite.
Yeah.
Because it makes sense, you know, you're scared, you don't know where to go,
yeah.
you don't know whether to wear masks or not, whether these masks are the correct ones or not, and you're looking for guidelines. So I think that having the discussion in Twitter is great, because now... It's a fast discussion in a moment where you needed to have these
mm-hmm.
fast discussions.
Mm-hmm.
But the bad thing is now this is open to everyone, which is nice because it brings transparency, but it's bad because it confuses people.
Yeah.
And it creates this sense that the information that you're getting, like, you cannot trust it.
Yeah.
And I think that we as a scientist, we need to figure out how to actually communicate better with, like, people that don't have our backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we're not trained for it, so we don't know how to do it.
Or just sometimes to leave Twitter like Christian Drosten and to say, I tried it, but that's it.
Yeah.
I did whatever I can.
Yeah. Like, that's fair. But like at the same time, you know, like the world is evolving towards that.
Yes.
And if we don't have the experts there explaining things to people, then we leave a hole for other people to fill it.
Yes.
So that's also a problem, right?
Yeah,
so
I think that's the main problem. Yeah. I mean, we have the journalists, science journalists.
Yeah.
They try to fill in this gap between scientists and the public. But sometimes also the journalist, it's a difficult game.
It is very difficult, especially because of the thing that, you know, science is learning things, is changing, and this is normal. And so I don't know, like maybe like I think that actually we are, at least where I grew up in Venezuela, and like you were taught of the scientific method of thinking and all of this, but like maybe like we need to teach it even more, like highlight this every now and then to people, like that this is the way, like, you know, that we think of things, that not everything is like definite. I don't know. Yeah. I think maybe it starts with the education even from the beginning.
Yeah, like, that's the point we turn into now. We dive into your biography of your scientific training in America. You studied chemical engineering, so I go now a little bit through your vita at the Northwestern University, and then you received your PhD very successfully in bioengineering from the University of California in San Diego. 5 years you focused all your attention on one peculiar idea or thesis. It's called protease, right?
Mm-hmm.
Detection in whole blood and other complex biological samples. So for me, it sounds like this work is somewhere located between basic and applied science,
100%.
Something in between, right? Detection sounds like, let's build something to make the complex samples readable and understandable.
That's pretty much it.
Very
good.
You got it. So could you explain now to our listeners, what does it mean? What does this word bioengineering mean?
So bioengineering is... well, that's a good question. So it's like this field between like biology and engineering, like how, like it's for us to understand how our body does the amazing things that it does, and how can we modify either our bodies or like a plant or an animal in order for it to do whatever we want. So in the case of human body, it can be like understanding how cancer works, and now engineering a cell so it can fight cancer. So like in the case of like a plant, it can, or like a bacteria, I can like engineer a bacteria, for example, in order for it to eat plastic. So it's like understanding how, like the first thing is like understanding the biology, and then how can we as humans intervene to do something that is hopefully beneficial for humanity. Hopefully.
So to
sounds
speak,
scary,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, no, but it's like Frankenstein.
A little bit like this.
So to build something, to understand biological processes, right, in the body, and then to build something which behaves similar to a cell or bacteria, virus, whatever. Because engineering is for me also in this sense of the word ingenieur sein, right? It's to design something.
Correct. Right? So it's like to design a lot of things like that we have been doing as humans for a while. It's like using like bacteria cells or other type of cells so they can produce proteins that we use like for drugs or for, I don't know, chemical processes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's like nature is super smart. I mean, like what our bodies or like things in nature do are insane.
This is a very good quotation for the listeners also. Please remind that nature is super smart.
Yeah.
Yes. So I understand this engineering thing. I read once a paper in my own PhD thesis about life sciences from a cell biologist. The title of this article was Why Can't a Biologist Fix a Radio? And the point was about the language of experts in biology, cell biology, to understand cancer and how the proteins work and the enzymes and everything like that. But the point was they couldn't explain why a protein has, like, I don't know, about 10,000 expressions. They can't explain why they behave, why they make genes on and off or whatever. And the biologist has written in this paper that they have to think more like an engineer, like someone who builds something in order to understand the processes better, how to manipulate
correct. So, but like, elements. But biology is a lot more complex sometimes of what we as humans or, like, you know, can do. So like, we try to oversimplify it sometimes and say, like, oh, if we play around with these two proteins, then we can produce the third protein because it's a input, output, all of this.
Yes.
But in reality, we're everything is more complex than this, and this is why a lot of experiments fail, and this is why like scientific advancements in this field like take quite a long time and a lot of effort.
That's why we have also different interdisciplinary configurations, like, for example, biochemistry, biophysics, bioinformatics, so on. So have you studied some of these areas too?
So I did some bioinformatics, biophysics, like, during my studies, and so
what was do you have any favorite
subjects?
Yeah, something like
so in
were really stuck into.
I don't know. Like when I was in undergrad, I think I really like. It's gonna be super nerdy, but I really enjoy thermodynamics in general. And then when I went to grad school, I really enjoy biochemistry in general. Yeah, because it's like all of the processes that happen in you or like in nature that make things.
Yes.
So I enjoy it quite a lot. And also, like, you know, it's crazy to think that, like, the configuration of a couple atoms, like, make things happen, you know?
Yeah.
And you change them a little bit and they make something completely different happen. Yeah. So it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Nature's wonders. Yes. So I think it's a really promising field of research, because basic and applied science are, like, intertwined in this area. It builds a very important bridge, and it has also medical purposes. Right? So engineers invent procedures, techniques to solve problems. They both come together. They can offer, I would say, some benefits for the society, right?
That's what we hope.
That's what you hope. So so we are specialized in this blood samples. For example, diabetes type 2, right? Early cancer detection, which I also am very interesting in it. Maybe you can also say something more about that. Because they are to most of the global diseases of the human race.
Correct. And growing.
And growing, still growing. So what has... The one question would be, what has influenced your decision to take this path to this global disease?
Well, I think to an extent it's a personal decision a little bit. I think that we all have been affected by one or the other disease, like this chronic metabolic disorder such as type 2 diabetes are super present in society. So when I was doing this work, I was in the US, and essentially like 10% of Americans have type 2 diabetes or close to it, which is high.
Yeah.
Like, this is adults, but there is also actually
for children.
Yeah, right? It's also present in children as well. And like 1 in 5 or something like this also have pre-diabetes. So trying to understand why is this happening was very interesting to me, and also, like, in a way a little bit selfish, because it's like, how can I prevent it, like, how can it prevent it from happening to me or my loved ones, you know? Mm-hmm. Like,
mm-hmm. especially in detection, early detection cancer. I mean,
yeah, also, and then the cancer is the same. Like, I have, like, many other people been touching this, like, with this, like, horrific disease. And we all know that if we can catch it early, then we can do something about it. And then a lot of the times we catch it way late when there's nothing to do. And where you have had like 10 plus years of something being developing inside of you that you didn't know. So I've always, I don't know if I've always been like obsessed with this idea, but like I became more obsessed with the idea that essentially like tracking different biomarkers in your blood was a good idea to understand your status quo. Like, because like right now you go to the doctor once a year if if you are lucky and if you're following like what you're supposed to,
if you get
to,
an appointment
and then you get these blood samples, you don't really like, you don't get an answer from the doctor. Like, actually I did this like not so long ago. I went to the doctor, got a blood sample, they never called me, I assume because everything was fine. But like, you don't know, you don't know your values, you don't know anything. So like, there's no way like of tracking this, like of, and so I became a little bit obsessed with this idea of like, hey, let's track more things. Like, we track our steps, we track
everything,
like
yes.
all of these things, and like we track all of our data.
Maybe you have to work together with Apple
for,
for biomarkers. Apple tracking.
No, there is a lot. There is a lot happening in the field. The one of the issues with the field right now is like that you can track a lot of biomarkers and you can detect things early in a way, but it's so early that you don't even know what to do about it. You know?
Yes.
So this is the second
we talked
question.
About it. We talked about it about this, especially regarding early detecting cancer, because maybe you see an infection or a biomarker who's like on the limit of something, but the doctor couldn't say, let's see, maybe this therapy. Oh no, because it's too early. We don't know which cancer may.
Like we don't even know where the tumor is.
You don't know.
But but in a way that this could, you know, you, there are things still that you could do, right? Like now you could be a little bit more careful, like with going to your appointments in the doctor once a year or once every 6 months. So the first moment that they can do something about it, something can be done. And in reality, there's also a lot of things that we can do to live a healthier life, right? Like we can eat better, we can exercise a little bit more and all of this. And if you know that you're more propensed to do something, like to develop something, probably you're gonna be a little bit more inclined to take care of yourself.
So are there any tools, technical tools to detect biomarkers at home? Does something like this exist in the US?
There,
you know what I mean?
So actually, I work in a company that used to do this, but they were like basic biomarkers, and like the tests were developed like in the 70s or so. So we were taking like this urine strip, that the one that when you go to the doctor, you be on the strip and they say like, oh yeah, you have an infection or not. But you can also monitor things like glucose, some liver proteins as well. And and so you can keep track of this. So like this exists and you can get them and you can like track things at home. There are other tests that, I mean, now like we do, a lot of people that don't have type 2 diabetes are doing like glucose monitoring with the CGM, like so the continuous glucose monitoring devices that you put in your shoulder and then you track your glucose levels all the time. This is not only like, this is of course for type 2 diabetics, very helpful, but it, and also type 1, but it's also helpful for these people that are into tracking different biomarkers, because now you can see what is your response to glucose with different foods. So maybe if you like, maybe if I eat, I don't know, an ice cream, my glucose spikes like crazy, but maybe when you eat an ice cream you have more tolerance and you're kind of fine, so I'll be less inclined to be eating ice creams because I'm going to have like a sugar crash. And you'll be like, oh, I can do it. You know, because we don't all have the same responses. That's the other thing, right? Like the other thing that I always got me bothered, and why I like this detection of biomarkers into blood or other biofluids, is that we're different people and we are being compared like with this normal, you know, you go to a doctor and it's like, oh yeah, your levels are normal.
Mm-hmm.
And the normal is like, honestly, a 70-year-old man that, that's when the normals were created, all of the studies were done on this 70-year-old white man.
Yeah. So there's
from Western society.
Yeah.
So like, is this normal for me? So I think that finding our normal is important.
This is very important. Yeah.
And this you can do when you track, mm-hmm. like over time,
mm-hmm.
or at least when you review some of these standards that were done in male, and at least like, you know, correct them for gender also, like. Racial, and so yeah
that's a good point. So as I read in your bio note, you have a lot of experience in product management of biopharma companies, so we are going more and more into the business of how to make and I call it business because I mean it's
well, it is a business.
It's a business. As a consultant, a co-founder in this sense, say you changed from science to in another area where you can be an engineer. So and now you live and work in Berlin as head of strategy for Alcura Medical. Very good name. A company specialized in creating big data platforms designed to accelerate clinical research. I remembered that it was something like this when I talked also with your boss. So your office is not the laboratory anymore, right? So now you are creating thesis and ideas out of personalized medicine and big data. So I remember when we met in your office, I saw co-working spaces, some kind of maps, diagrams, maybe from the last brainstorming session. How does your work differ now from the work as PhD student, or how does it feel to be not more like doing science but creating something in personalized medicine for engineering for you know, this kind of stuff? So how does it change?
So there's a lot of changes, but there's also a lot of similarities. So like my PhD, as you mentioned, was really applied science.
Mm.
So this is a similarity. This is still applied science. Like, you know, essentially we take the learnings from basic science and we try to use some technology, engineering, in order for it to bring, hopefully, again, a benefit to society.
Yeah.
So this is the similar part. Then the difference is, you already pointed one, I don't work in a wet lab anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work in a wet lab. I actually like it quite a lot. I still consult to some like startups, and some of them have labs and all of this. And every now and then I get to an experiment. It's cool, you know, feel like this old person, like with the papers.
So a little bit you used to...
But very, very little, very, very, very little. Like this, like wet lab stuff, very little, but I actually miss it a little bit, to be honest, because it, like, I always like the creating part, and I always like the creativity out of it. Like, it sounds like it's not a creative business, but in the end it kind of is, you know.
In the end it's a little bit Frankenstein,
a little bit, you know. So
yeah,
and it's a little bit like cooking, you know, you do things. So that's different. Another point that is different is, like, in academia, and maybe you can relate to this, you're working on this very small, not small problem, but like very specific problem that maybe like 10 people in the world work on. And that's it.
I know it.
Yeah, you know this, right? And it can be quite isolating, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that I wasn't really a fan of. Like, even though I had a very collaborative team, and like all of the projects that I work during my PhD and postdoc were very collaborative, and I had the opportunity to discuss things with people, but in the end you were focused on very specific thing that only a few people knew or care to talk about it. And normally your output is a scientific publication that is going to be read by 20 people, and that's it, you know? And this I didn't love, and I'm happy that this is not my work anymore. And what I like about like working in companies and working like especially like in the startup environments in which you are like creating products and in a way like from zero, from scratch, you know, like from basic ideas, is that you're working with a team, and that everybody's, you know, pushing towards the same goal, and this is quite nice, and I appreciate that quite a lot.
Like, I can see it in your eyes. Yes. So, could you explain us a little bit more what is a head of strategy and like what? So, what are you exactly? Can you describe a little bit? Normal day.
There are no normal days in a startup of 20 people, and there is no like one particular role that everybody has that is set in stone, especially like for people that are more in the head positions. Like we cover gaps wherever we see them, but I'm in charge of defining the commercial and product strategy of the company. So trying to understand where is a good space for us to be in, because as you mentioned, we have a data and AI platform, and this is for clinical research, but it can do so many things. It's a platform, it's in theory therapy agnostic, so it can go in many, many different directions. So it's finding where can we actually make the most, progress out of it, or where can we have more impact.
So you already need some economical knowledge also, like
correct. So like it's a little bit of a story of everything, so like that's part of it. Then there's a lot of general operations of a startup company, from team building stuff, like also like so do anything really.
Do your company startup have big competitors in this field?
We have competitors, of course we do. It is still relatively new and open field, and up until recently, actually a lot of biopharma, who's our customer essentially, was a little bit afraid of getting into the AI business, and now they feel a little bit more pressure to get into it.
Oh sure.
So more and more companies are popping up.
So the economical strategies will become more and more important. Now, right?
Correct.
Okay, so we have this I mean, basic science needs a lot of data to test a thesis, right? And to reproduce results. And you told us now that you are also a platform for a lot of clinical studies. Maybe you also need big data from hospitals in Germany to select, to make create an archive, right? And I know also from my personal story that everyone in the hospital has to sign something. Is your data free flowing, and all the clinical research are not, right? So this is about data rights in Europe and especially in Germany. So what would you say is the problem with that for your special business, like data mining or data gaining?
Like you mean like what's the problem in the sense that there are regulations around that?
The practical sense to
so to be honest, the way that I see, I don't see it as a problem, because I think that this data should be regulated.
Okay.
There is other places in the world that this data is more accessible, and I think that Europe and especially Germany at least is trying to take care of the privacy of the patients, and I think this is very important. So I think I really don't see it as a problem. It is more challenging to do the work that we do because the data is not easily accessible.
You have this bureaucratical.
You have it's not only like,
you have to go through,
but it also like opens up not only like the fact that you have to like more bureaucracy to do things, but like, you know, it opens up for you to think of ways that you can do it in a better way. Like, so what we do, for example, in Aikura is that we use what's called federated learning. Mm-hmm. So we do machine learning, so which is a specialized type of AI, without moving the data around. So we move the algorithms around. Okay. So the algorithms learn from the data in the hospitals, mm-hmm. but the data never leaves the place where it's generated.
Okay.
So in this way, you know.
So the AI creates a spider web between
correct.
The data.
And it's learning, like, and this is a way that you can maximize the knowledge that you have in this data, which I think is important because mm-hmm. in the end, we actually want to use this data so then we can better treat patients.
Yes. Yes.
Like, yes. And so I think it's important to use the data, but I think it's very important to use the data in a responsible way. So it's okay. In my opinion, it's fine that there's hurdles to access this data because otherwise it will be a mess. I mean, we, you know, like it's, you go to a hospital and you assume that your data should be kept mm-hmm. private and all of this is, you know, a human right, to be honest.
Yeah.
So like,
yeah.
So I think it's fine that there are hurdles. I don't see it as an issue, to be honest.
And in the US, there are other rights, or they are more.
It's more liberal, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like it's not like free access to all, but it is just a little bit easier. And also, like I said, like at least Europe is trying. Because it's not like everything that is being done is amazing, or it's really not so easy to deal with all of these data privacy issues.
Mm.
Because also, like, things are changing so fast that regulators can barely adapt, you know?
Yes,
like,
that's the point, yeah.
Or, like, cannot adapt, actually, direct.
And we also didn't know, maybe, I mean... In this one point where the data of our private hospital disease will come also to health insurance policies.
Correct. So it can have so many ramifications. So like I think it's very, very important to at least try to protect it, you know. And I think the responsible thing as a company that uses clinical data of patients, and one thing that we all have to remember is that we're all gonna be patients because like patient sounds like very like outside me, and it's like I will be a patient.
Yeah,
like we are all gonna be patients, so we all have to think about it also like in a selfish way, right?
Yeah,
so like, you know, we have to be very careful with the data of patients, and if we are using it, it's our responsibility to think of like what is the way that we can protect the privacy of this.
Yes. So on the other hand, I would say I'm very happy that we have this big collections of individual disease histories.
Correct.
Patient histories, right? Especially in the case of cancer.
Correct. In many diseases, to be honest.
Yeah. To have the comparison between them, right? And to see more similarities between the histories and to decide early, this sounds familiar to me. We have to look at that because these two patients are...
Correct. And that's exactly what we're trying to do in Aikura, which is like, how do we maximize the use of the data that we now have in order to better treat patients?
Yeah.
Like that's the goal.
So,
easier said than done.
Let's turn to that, because I'm very interested, for example, what are now the new most popular drugs someone should invest in? I mean, is there any promising data now, for example, for Alzheimer's or any other health issues, for example, neurodegenerative ways?
Yeah. Something when like you that. Say when you say like invest, do you mean like as a should I put my stock in a particular company?
Maybe for the listeners like, now of our podcast,
insider trading.
Yeah,
no, so that I cannot answer, to be honest. For multiple, first because I don't know. Like, that's the first reason. But second, like if I knew, it would be insider trading. So
maybe now a Gordon Gekko is listening or yeah. something like that.
Yeah. Nope. So. But in Alzheimer's, actually, these past years we have had the first good news in forever. Actually, we have never had good news in Alzheimer's mm-hmm. drug development. So now there is one drug approved for Alzheimer's that targets amyloid plaques. I don't know if you have heard of this, but like amyloid is this protein, and in the brain it forms like plaques of proteins,
yeah.
which then causes neurodegeneration and causes a lot of other problems. In the end, you end up with like Alzheimer's and like the physical manifestation of dementia. So for the first time in many, many years, there is one drug that now doesn't reverse the Alzheimer's. So it's not a perfect drug by any means, but at least slows it down a little bit.
Okay.
And there is a second drug that is up for approval. This is by Eli Lilly. And it's similar to the first drug that is approved. And again, it can slow down the disease, but it's not a perfect drug. But there's a lot of other drugs in the pipeline. Some target the same protein that causes the plaque, and others target other different targets that the disease has, because it's a very complex disease. It's not only like the plaques and problem solve, it's many different things. So there's many, many drugs in the pipeline that are like quite promising.
Okay. And iCura also works in
so,
this
yeah,
kind
so
of
we work so
drug
we,
development.
Yeah, so we work in, again, we have this platform, it's therapy agnostic, so theoretically you could do it for any therapy area, but because we're a small company, we're focused on neurology. Mm-hmm. And specifically in neurodegenerative diseases. So we are helping different research institutes, hospitals, and also biopharma mm-hmm. identifying novel biomarkers and identifying novel targets and like figuring out what is the best way to run their trials so we can like get some of these like nice drugs that are like in the pipeline approved. So
okay.
We can have a solution for patients.
So before a trial begin, you already have the data for
we
the...
have like data
yeah.
from past trials that
mm-hmm.
were either successful or not successful, and then we mine this data to try to understand
mm-hmm.
hey, this marker is a good idea to check
mm-hmm.
if these patients have this marker, they should have this particular drug, like also
mm-hmm.
like trying to bring
yeah.
some personalization into the
yes.
Alzheimer's field, which hasn't had any,
mm-hmm.
in part because it didn't have any even drugs that were like slowing down the disease.
Yes.
So,
yes. I remember that the last time we talked about this topic, that you told me some kind of new LSD research
yeah. so
or something like that is
yeah.
going on right now, also in
yeah.
this neurological cases.
Yeah. So. There is some LSD, yeah. There is all like, but in general, psychedelics are a big
now
thing.
Now I have
yeah.
Heard, yeah, psychedelics.
Yeah, they're a big thing, especially in mental health disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very important thing because there most of the depression patients like go like on I don't know many different drugs and none of them work like. It only works for like 30% of them or something like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And psychedelics are giving some amazing data.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we are doing is we are helping some of the companies understand like how exactly the psychedelics affect the brain
mm-hmm.
and how to tweak them so they can bring the most benefit to the patients.
So there are already trials going on about
okay. There are many trials.
Yes.
A lot
mm.
of them are for treatment resistant depression, so patients
wow.
that have had depression went on just the regular like serotonin receptor inhibitors and they didn't work, or also for PTSD participants, also mm-hmm. for addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of trials, most of them I think with psilocybin.
Mm-hmm.
There's also ketamine that is, I think, approved in several places for depression. So it's definitely like an interesting field, very promising.
But?
No but.
Okay, there is no but.
No but. But I'm not, but I guess the but, there is a little bit of a but. Still, we need to understand, like, if this worked for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Because the trials have been limited to a particular population, so we mm-hmm. need to understand if they work for everyone.
Yeah.
And also how to make them more accessible so more people can have access to them if they will benefit for them. Mm-hmm. Because, like, the, not issue, but the reality is that these trials are, you need to have therapists there with you for like 5 hours plus
mm-hmm.
time
mm-hmm.
while you're taking the drug.
Yeah.
And this is something that maybe in a lot of places won't be, like, you won't be able to have this access to.
Yes.
So
it's
like,
it's a bit difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to figure out how to make this more accessible, and also like to continue gathering data and understanding if this replicates in the general population or doesn't, because the trials right now have been like quite restrictive
mm-hmm.
because
there were also trials here in Germany, Switzerland, US were the most.
To be honest, I wouldn't dare to say
mm-hmm.
because I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Canada runs a lot of trials. I know the UK as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the US, you have different states where
mm-hmm.
the rules are different.
Yeah.
It's all a little bit about regulations and all of this. So.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know in Germany if they're like running trials or not.
I will Google on that topic.
Yeah.
Note to myself.
Yes.
So in the company, let's talk now about AI Cura, right? Mm-hmm. There is this big AI factor in this name. We know now from our own interactions with ChatGPT, open source, how OpenAI is learning very fast, accelerating every processes. I know it from of my own fields of work, also when I give my lectures at the university and students have to write something, and I sometimes ask, I think this was made up of ChatGPT did this, right? Oh yeah, how do you know that? Yeah, the grammar is too perfect.
Yeah, like you're not that smart.
Yeah, you're not that smart. So please use ChatGPT more like a human being. Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So, how do you, like, before you ask me a question, actually, how do you deal with this?
I mean, in the humanities, it's now a very big point. I see it not as a threat in any way.
And I
talk with my students open about that.
Yeah.
So the guy who used ChatGPT, and he was not the only one, right?
Yeah.
They used it as a kind as a dialogue. So he took something of ChatGPT, but then he added something his own ideas.
Yeah.
So it was a mix up, a combination of both. Still I have said that, you know, you can do it, so it's no problem, right?
Yeah.
But please think about that. Your job will be, you will be a teacher in the school, and sometimes you need your own ethics of knowledge and
of course
all this kind of stuff, how to judge, how to learn, how do you as a teacher, you have a kind of imperative of pedagogical, you know, ethics. You need to train human beings, young human beings, right?
Yeah.
In languages, in literatures, whatever, in media. And for me, it's no problem as long as they do it with some kind of consciousness.
Yeah, correct.
What they are doing there.
Have you changed like your lectures because of it, or like the assignments that you give? Have you changed anything?
No, it's still the same, and I know. Someone who works with it or not, I talk then with them about that in person, and that's it.
Yeah.
So I have nothing changed in my work as a lecturer on the university, but maybe we will see how it will work with BA thesis, MA thesis when they use it. It will be a problem, but when you train them consciously about this topic,
I don't think that you can like avoid it, right?
Yes.
And in a way, it's also another tool that now is available. And if they don't use it, they'll fall behind. So it's like, you know, like it's just like more like, how do we now think about like what we have to teach and how we teach it and all of this? Yeah.
And sometimes it's always like a good chat with a friend.
Yeah.
And then you have a great idea. Ah, I can write it down. And then I can ask, well, is this your idea or the idea of Augusta from where comes this idea? So it's an artificial intelligence. So I think, when we can talk about the how to use them, the conditions of creativity, that it's not a threat. It can be a threat, but I think in the humanities we can talk about it freely, and we have philosophies about the machine. I also have an edition a few years ago about man machine units and the MIT labs 80 years ago. So it's a great topic. I love this topic about man machines, but in my own personal philosophy, I would say the machine is not a threat.
Yeah.
It is our creature.
Yeah.
We we are still the god.
For now. We'll see.
Yeah, we will see. So yeah, that would be my impression from my point of view. Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. So Aikura, you already explained some procedures, how you work with AI, how the platform works. Could you give maybe to our listeners an example of how it works when a client uses this platform? What does the client do? What are the steps of this AI generated platform and content and
how
does the algorithm work?
Yeah, so like it really depends. It's a custom service in a way. So like the platform is a data platform at the beginning. So we talk with the client and we understand like what data do they want to include in this. If it's only their data, if they also want to connect to other research institutes with whom they collaborate, or if they're looking for collaborators, we can also help them broker these deals. And then we build for them like what we call a data layer. So it's essentially like their
a layer own. It would be Schichten, right? Data layer.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be Schichten.
And so essentially it's like a database with all of their data. It's a smart database. It's based on graph models and like whatever. Mm. Essentially like it performs very fast and it's quite easy to like ask this data layer stuff. So now the client has the first thing that they gain from us is that they can have some clarity on what data do they have and what are like the demographics of their data, like, and ask like small questions to the data, and they already have like an answer for it. And this is already quite valuable because like in medicine we are generating so much data over the past years, and even getting a handle of like what did we generate is not trivial. So the first thing is like we put everything in one place so the client can easily access it in an interface that is easy to use. And then the second thing is like we help them like come up with what we call AI solutions. So we develop different solutions for whatever their needs are. So like, for example, like what biomarker can I get from brain images? So if you have a lot of MRI, magnetic resonant images, then what I don't know, should I look at the right side of the image, left side of the, like, what should I, like extract more information?
Because the AI is already, like, leading you through some, where do you have to look at?
Because these are, like, images that are, like, 3D. And, like, normally the way that, like, a radiologist goes through it is, like, he stares at it a little bit, and then they're super well-trained, so they can, like, tell things super fast.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit of a qualitative assessment. So, like, even, like, you know, we can build models so you can have, in-depth analysis of your images. And, like help you understand if there's anything interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So okay. So we essentially like help create these AI solutions which are very customer dependent.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these image analysis solutions,
mm-hmm.
because we as humans cannot extract the complexity of information from these like very complex image modalities.
Mm-hmm.
So we need like the AI there.
Those algorithms, yeah.
So a lot of them are image.
So it's
related.
Like an artificial radiologist.
Something. It's more than an artificial radiologist, to be honest.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because like our radiologist is excellent at their job, but they're like normally looking at one particular disease, or like they're just looking at whether something is present or absent.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually taking an incredibly complex image
mm-hmm.
and like recognizing patterns. Mm-hmm. So one thing that we, like the radiologist is not necessarily good at, is like at remember all of the images that he has ever seen, and like saying oh, I remember this part, like the pattern from this matches it, like this is very especially because like a radiologist right now has to look at thousands of images in their shifts.
Yes.
So like
this is a lot of data.
So they just look at they glance at things.
Yeah.
So they're like excellent at recognizing this like presence or absence of things.
Mm.
But not so much at like extracting data patterns.
Yeah. And especially to compare it in order to make...
And also like to combine it with the other information and all of this. So so it really depends. But like, I guess the bread and butter of what we do is trying to figure out what's the best way to run the next clinical trial that will be the fastest, and that also will be... they'll give them the best chance of having the drug approved for a particular population that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing this personalized medicine approach.
So do you already use ChatGPT, the latest version, for some kind of...
We do, like, as a company, we use it, but it's very... for nothing super special, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So because we do our own things, so we can like we don't do it with the clinical data because we cannot send the clinical data to OpenAI, and we won't. like we wouldn't. So we do it, for example, like for marketing messages and things.
Perfect.
Like this.
Every email of Ikora is written by ChatGPT.
You're welcome. So for these things we use, and also for certain features of the platform, like so sometimes you build what we call queries, which is like trying to like segment the data, and these are very become very very cumbersome. So then we use something, it's not ChatGPT, but something like ChatGPT that helps you translate this cumbersome thing into just your normal language. You're now looking at patients that have Alzheimer's disease and are between these ages and have scores of this and that. And like, and you don't need to see a complex diagram. Mm-hmm. You see like just the way that you will speak. So we use it like for cosmetic things, I'll say.
Okay.
But we develop our own tools
and
we don't use anything that we don't agree with their data policies.
Okay. Maybe you are the better Silicon Valley.
Not so much, but
yeah. Short question to that. A following question. It's just a little question. Big data needs a lot of, I think, big servers where they are located.
Yeah.
Right? Are they here in Germany? The servers?
For now, yeah.
Okay.
Or like whatever the company that we work with is.
Okay.
So we work with the companies that are not only in Germany, so
okay.
And and the data of the companies stay on premise of their company.
Okay.
So normally like the biopharma companies that we work with, they have already their data policies, whether they use the cloud or they use like actual servers.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's their problem. We support both. Mm-hmm. And we also can advise what makes the most sense for the amount of data that they have for for regulation, for regulatory purposes. So.
Okay, cool. In the end, what do you say are the pros and cons of AI in this kind of bioengineering field?
Okay.
And I mean, also maybe you can choose scientifically, politically, ethically.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you can also make a philosophy out of it.
Yeah, it's difficult. Eh? Like, I mean, pros, like, I think for life sciences, for
mm-hmm.
healthcare, it
mm-hmm.
makes sense.
Mm.
And we just have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be very conscious of protecting patients' privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like, this is going to help us accelerate a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we should absolutely make use of it. But, you know, if we're delayed like 6 months because we did it correctly, I think it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
So I think that it's okay to take a beat and think about like what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that we have to use it.
Yeah.
Like I
there's no way back.
Exactly.
So
like
yeah.
there's no way back and there shouldn't be. Like, you know,
yes.
like I'm in the end a techno optimist, like think that we should go for it. But I think that we also should try to be careful.
Yes.
And that is not again, like
yeah.
that a little delay
yeah.
in a result is okay.
Yeah, yeah. Now the discussion is in the humanities that now all the professors from ethical philosophy now ask, we are too late with our questions to the machine, with the ethical rules we have to give to the machine, right? And it's, yeah, it's always the same. The creature is here, but now we have to control that, right? That's always the point. Well, I would like to end our conversation with a very important key issue on, I would say, sociological level of science. A total other topic, but I would like to end with this issue. Women are really rare in scientific business. Still, I think there is still this great gap from a feministic point of view. So also I would say as a head of strategists and startups and so on. That's why I'm very curious, what is your opinion about women in natural sciences, women in biotech companies? What are your experiences? Will you maybe one day say that you will go back to the laboratory, leave the company, being isolated again on your
mm-hmm.
island doing research?
No,
or,
I don't think so.
How have you experienced the long road from PhD now to the business as a woman? What was your special female experience in the natural sciences?
I mean, I don't know if it's special or not, and also like because I didn't have another experience, then I don't have the comparison of being a male in these fields. But I think that there are more women going into the sciences in general. It's my perspective, which is very good, but like there's still this gap between who is on top and who's not on top.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a point in which when you get there, you are surrounded by male colleagues.
Mm-hmm. How was it in the US when you did your PhD there?
It's also, in a way, during the PhD, there were female colleagues, and then as you grow in your career,
mm-hmm.
they start like somewhat dropping.
Mm-hmm.
I also did engineering school,
mm-hmm.
and in engineering in general, like we were probably like 30% of the class or less, like
females.
Okay. So it's not high.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it has always been there. And I think what can make a difference is to see like people in the top positions,
mm-hmm.
because this is inspiring. And also, like, you need this mentorship in a way, which is more difficult to get as a female than as a male, I think. And sometimes, like, your male mentorship, like, even though they mean well, it's not that they don't mean well, it just doesn't translate to your experience. Like, or so I think this has to,
so the mentorship is still male dominated, right? Like,
well, because the people in the top positions are still male, they're still mostly male, right? So I think the way to, not the way to change it, but like this, like, essentially this won't be changed until this other part changes, until we have more people on the top, and then you have these examples that then you can see yourself there, and then you continue to push. Because I mean, the reality is that it's a lot of work, you sacrifice things, so if you think that you're not going anywhere, then it's easy to drop it, right?
Yes.
So I think this is missing still, and it's difficult in a way to change, because to change it, you have had to change it before, like, in
yes.
a way.
Yes, this is the history about the gender gap in natural sciences.
So it's so it's a little bit difficult. And also, I've seen, like, one thing that I've seen in startups is very, very rarely we have female-founded companies that get the money. It's like less than 5%.
Wow.
Or something like this. Like, I founded a company with a female friend and colleague, and it was incredibly difficult to get money. And we will see our male counterparts doing half of the work, half of everything, and getting millions of euros for no particular reason. So I think, I think some investors, even male investors, want to change this, but I think that they don't put the money where they put the words sometimes. So I think that will help if they start putting their money where their words are. And I also don't think that this is, like, philanthropic or anything, because a lot of the female-led companies do better, actually, because we tend to be more careful.
Yes.
We tend to be more stingy with the money, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, I actually think it's a wise business decision. Like, it's not the only philanthropic, really.
Yes. Perfect. So what would you say, do you have any advice for young women in the science business or scientific field, something you would like to have known earlier by yourself in your career, for example? Any idea what you can give back to our listeners?
I think to start maybe or change the field. Yeah, I think like to not be afraid of things, to know that essentially that you can do it, and that also there's a lot of people that are there to help you now. You have to a little bit search for them, but
to make some kind of a little network around yourself with
friends. I think doing a network always helps. Like, having, like, a little bit of your tribe helps.
Your tribe, very good. Very good concept, yes.
So I think that helps. But in general, like, this, like, not being afraid of failure also, like, I think is very important. I think, like, we female in general are taught to be a little bit more afraid of failing or to doing things wrong. So you fail a lot of times, and that's fine. Like,
and you will get up, make it better,
and
next
then that's
time.
It, and it's fine. And this is how you learn, and this is how you do things well, like, at some point, or better.
And we learned today that science is always about learning.
Correct.
So this is the point where we end for today, Augusta. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much, Patricia. It was great.
Yeah, it was really cool. So thank you very much also to our listeners today. We talked in English, and I hope you understand our English, also for the German listeners. So have a nice day today.
Yeah,
and
you too.
And hopefully we see each other next time for another podcast round, maybe.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Das war Augusta Modestino zu Gast bei Virale Wissenschaft. Auch in der nächsten Folge wird es mit den Frauen in der Wissenschaft weitergehen. Dann darf ich die Molekularbiologin Dr. Jelka Peric-Kacarevic bei uns begrüßen, die sowohl in der Lehre als auch in der Forschung tätig ist und sich mit der Entwicklung und dem Marketing von biomedizinischen Materialien beschäftigt. Darüber hinaus ist sie aber auch zweifache Mutter. Wir werden daher nicht nur über Frauen in der Wissenschaft sprechen, sondern vor allem über Mutterschaft zwischen Karriere, Wissenschaft und Alltag. Bis dahin, alles Gute. Wir hören uns demnächst.